It is January 17th. Time is flying by, especially when we have multiple snow days. I just wanted to let folks kind of know the plan this morning. We've got one bill introduction. Again, I ask for your vote simply for purposes of introducing it as a Senate committee rules and not for your support or opposition to the substance of the measure. We have two executive appointments in person, Mr. Stephen Powers and Dr. Janine Smith. And then my understanding and a likely story, I'm sure, is Dr. Ernest Etlick is stuck in snowbound at Medford, Ashland area. So we're going to try and hook him up by phone. This is Krista's first phone conference, so everybody keep your fingers crossed. We will then move to Mr. Burson and do testimony we're hoping to do on Tuesday of this week, and then we'll hopefully have time to open it up for public testimony. I have a conference call that I need to attend at 11:40, so hopefully someone can take the gavel as we move through public testimony. And then in terms of next week, we are scheduled to meet Thursday morning as well, next week at 10:30, and then hoping to have another evening scheduled for public testimony. We're hoping, we're looking at Thursday evening, but need to check everybody's calendars and make sure everyone can be here. But that's so far the only evening that we know that we would have for next week. So, any questions, comments, concerns, or frustrations? Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Just for clarification, Madam Chair, Thursday morning at 10:30.
Yes.
Great.
And then we're looking for another evening time next week.
Perfect.
That everyone can join us.
Thank you.
So that the public can come tell us what we should be doing. So, okay, with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on bill introductions and move that. I'm sorry?
It's a work session.
Work session. Sorry. We don't want to do work session on LC 1537. The relating clause provides that product liability civil actions are not subject to statute of ultimate repose. I'd ask again for your, the motion is to adopt the bill as a committee bill. I'd ask for your vote, not as to the substance of the measure, but simply for the purposes of the bill being a committee measure. Any discussion? Any objections?
This is a terrible bill, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Senator Farioli. I appreciate your comments.
And, Madam Chair, I feel compelled to say that my participation in moving this forward this morning is simply as a courtesy to the chair.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Why don't we just kill the bill?
Thank you, Senator Nelson.
No, we can, there's another way to get around that, right?
Too early in the session for that to happen. Hearing no objection, the bill
Madam Chairman, my objection.
Oh, you are an objection.
For the record.
Okay, we will note your objection for the record.
Madam Chairman, my life continues as a speed bump in this process.
Thank you. All right. With that, the bill will be introduced as a committee bill, and then let's move to executive appointments. I'm opening a public hearing on the appointment of Stephen Powers to State Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. Mr. Powers, come on up. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and why you'd like to serve on this particular board, and welcome.
Thank you. Chair Brown, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Powers, and I live in Portland. I'm honored to be Governor Kulongoski's nominee for the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, issuing over 1,500 orders a month, which range from establishing conditions of community supervision for the approximately 575 offenders who are released from Department of Corrections custody each month, to issuing orders after approximately 20 hearings every month for offenders whose crimes include aggravated murder, burglary, and robbery. The Board of Parole is one of the finest state agencies with a highly skilled and dedicated staff. If confirmed, I intend to use my experience as an assistant attorney general, where in addition to my normal caseload, I served as a co-lead attorney for the board's cases that were subject to judicial review by Oregon and federal courts. Additionally, having served as a petitions law clerk, public honors fellow, and extern at the Oregon Supreme Court, and having managed a team of attorneys who drafted ballot titles, I'm confident that my record of public service will allow me to be a productive member of the board. Again, I'm honored with this nomination and opportunity to apply my expertise and experience, and I'm grateful that you and members of the committee have added to that honor by your courtesy and respect in my meetings with you. If confirmed, I look forward to working with you and other members of the legislature on public safety issues and to upholding the board's important public safety mission. I cannot promise perfection, but I can commit to you and dedicate to the women and men of the Board of Parole that I will do my best to earn your faith and respect. And to the people of the state of Oregon, whom we all serve, I will commit to preserving the board's role as an institution deserving of the highest level of confidence and trust. Thank you, Chair Brown and members of the committee, for the opportunity to appear before you today.
Thank you, Mr. Powers. Questions? Senator Johnson?
I would just make a comment in lieu of a question. I had the opportunity to meet with Mr. Powers prior to this convening of the committee, and I have rarely seen such a comprehensive resume nor had such a positive and productive meeting with a nominee. I think we are very fortunate to have such a well-qualified nominee come forward and be willing to serve in this important role. And I am prepared to tell you right now, I will vote for this appointment with a great deal of pride. I think we're bringing somebody enormously qualified into the process.
Thank you. Senator Johnson, any other comments or questions?
Just to agree with that.
I agree.
Thank you.
Well,
you got off the hook this morning. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, I'm closing the public hearing. I'll not move to work session until Senator Farioli returns. Let's open a public hearing on the appointment of Dr. Jeanine Smith as Administrator of the Oregon Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research. Dr. Smith, why don't you come on forward? Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Dr. Jeanine Smith, and I was nominated to be the administrator for the Office of Health Policy and Research. I'm a third-generation Oregonian. I live in Senate District 14, and I've spent most of my education in the state university system, as you might note from my resume. I, as a family physician, have worked in a variety of healthcare settings, from the more urban setting of Portland and Philadelphia to the more rural outposts of South Central Alaska and the Aleutian Islands. And I've also been working in the office for the last 7 years and had the pleasure of working under Dr. Bruce Goldberg for the last 4 years as his deputy administrator, and was serving as the acting administrator for the past 10 months when he left to go over to the Department of Human Services. Though I have big shoes to fill, I believe my experience working in both the public and the private worlds of health, and in both a clinician and an administrator role, provide me with a lot of experience to provide a balance to this position, which was created by you, the legislature, back in the early days of the health plan to help you get the adequate information and data to make evidence-based health policy decisions. I appreciate, through my work with the state so far and my firsthand experience with patients and the public, that there are urban and rural differences, socioeconomic and cultural diversities that you as health policymakers must consider to build consensus in healthcare programs. This is a very great honor to serve in this capacity, especially at this time as the state is looking to see how best to improve access to health care and improve the health of all Oregonians. And I thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Mona Sanderson.
I have no questions because I've been honored to work with Dr. Smith for the last, year, really, when we started Senate Bill 31 and the Healthy Kids Plan that we're now considering House Bill 2201, which is virtually the same thing. She's been very open, very knowledgeable, able to help us craft a bill, I think, that is going to be great for the state of Oregon. And anyway, again, when we said about Mr. Powers, I say the same thing for Dr. Smith. I think we should be honored to have someone of her caliber working for us.
Senator Nelson?
Yeah, I'm always just impressed with the scope of the experience that people bring to these commissions.
Senator Johnson?
Thank you. Doctor, to what degree will your office be involved in helping to do any analysis on some of the health care reform packages that are coming forward for legislative consideration?
Chair Brown and Senator Johnson, our office has been working very closely with all of the health care reform efforts. We staff the Oregon Health Policy Commission and have been working with them to develop their recommendations as directed by the governor. And we have watched and helped participate in the Senate Commission on Health Care Access and Affordability of Senator Bates and Westland. We also have been working with the Northwest Health Foundation to work with all the staffers of all the health reform projects projects, the Archimedes, or OBC, the Providence, all of them collectively, and we're trying to do analysis of getting what's the differences and what are the similarities, as well as how can we all kind of talk about this similarly and how close are we to reaching some consensus.
Follow-up.
Sarah Johnson.
Thank you very much. I hope that as you begin that analysis that you will feel free to distribute it to the legislature. For some of us, unlike our colleague Senator Montes Anderson, who was up until recently a practitioner in the healthcare field, for some of us we don't have the same level of expertise coming to the debate. And to the degree that we have unbiased experts helping us sort out the differences in ways that are intelligible to laypersons, that would be a very useful piece of information.
Chair Brown, Senator Johnson, that is really the role of the office, is to help translate, and just as a family physician needs to translate complicated medical stuff to a patient, I see that as a very important role for us to make sense to everybody so everybody can understand all these things, because it's going to impact everybody.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. We really appreciate you joining us this morning. Appreciate your willingness to serve the state.
Thank you.
Any questions for Dr. Powers? Okay. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on the Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research. And Krista, can we get a hold of Dr. Etlick? Possibly. Do I need to push something?
It'll fade.
Okay. Maybe.
Maybe.
That's an interesting resume, too.
Yeah.
Speech and
theater. Okay, I'm going to watch that.
Hello?
Hello.
Is this Dr. Etlick?
This is he.
Hi, we understand you're stuck somewhere.
We're in Ashland with lots of fight.
Okay. Well, I'm Kate Brown. I'm chairing the committee this morning. To my left is the good Senator Betsy Johnson, the good Senator Ted Ferrioli, and to my right, the good Senator David Nelson and the Senator Montes Anderson. The committee hearing room is somewhat full, but you are being piped throughout the Capitol, so just be aware of anything that you may say, because it would be recorded for posterity. So.
Okay, thank you, Senator.
Could you tell us a little bit about yourself and why you'd like to serve on the Commission on Judicial Fitness and Disability? And with that, I'm going to open a public hearing.
Okay. I'm a college professor administrator who's been at Southern Oregon University for 30 years. I'm now retired in 2003. And during that time was vice president academic at Southern for about 15 of those years, and was interim president for one of those years. And have been primarily, I'm trained as a rhetorician, that is a person who's interested in public discourse.
Thank you for explaining that. You were getting some confused looks at the dais.
And then have also been involved in ethics, primarily philosophical, but have worked with professional ethics, especially when a good friend, Frank Van Dyke, died, and we established a professional ethics seminar here in the Valley with Steve Ryder and John Dellenbach in Frank's name. And that dealt with medical, political, governmental, and so on, business ethics. So, I'm not sure how much more you would like to know about me. I am very active in the Presbyterian Church, and have just finished serving as moderator of the presbytery here in Western Oregon.
Thank you. Let me see if there's anyone on the committee who has questions. Sarah Nelson?
Yes, I just appreciate the fact that you're willing to put forth the effort to do this. I see what you were at the University of Oregon studying rhetorical therapy or theory and getting an MS.
It wasn't therapy.
Well, I was there. I was there at the same time, probably getting therapy or trying to get an undergraduate degree. And so I appreciate that and the fact that you have a wealth of knowledge and really appreciate the fact you're stepping forward to assume some responsibility. Thank you.
Well, after 15 years as vice president academic and working with the state board and having a number of people serve on that board at great cost, I think maybe I have a debt to pay.
Thank you. Other questions?
Yes.
Sarah Johnson?
No, thank you. I had a very comprehensive conversation with Dr. Affleck on the telephone, and he satisfied the questions that I had at that time.
Senator Farrielly?
No question.
I guess you're off the hook, Dr. Affleck. I really appreciate your willingness to serve on this commission. I think it's extremely important that we maintain the credibility and functionality of all three branches of Oregon's government, and obviously that includes the judicial branch as well. So we appreciate your willingness to take time and energy out of your busy schedule to serve, and we'll have someone, Ms. Nancy Goss-Duran from the governor's office, will keep you posted regarding your appointment.
Thank you so much, and I do appreciate all of the kindness you folks have shown in order to help me not have to travel yesterday.
All righty. Take good care. Thank you.
Thank you.
This one? Okay. All right. That, I'm going to close the public hearing on the Commission on Judicial Fitness and Disability. So let's move into work session on executive appointments. I'm going to open a work session on the appointment of Stephen Powers to the State Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, and then move the appointment to the Senate floor with the recommendation that the appointment be confirmed. Any discussion other than lauding Mr. Powers' praises? Any objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing none? So ordered. I'm going to open a work session and on the Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research, and I would move the appointment of Dr. Jeanine Smith as the administrator of the Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research to the Senate floor with the recommendation that the appointment be confirmed. Any further discussion other than lauding her credentials as well? Any objections to that appointment? Hearing and seeing none? So ordered. And then let's move to work session on the appointment of Ernest Etlick to the Commission on Judicial Fitness and Disability. I would move the appointment of Dr. Etlick to the Commission on Judicial Fitness and Disability to the Senate floor with the recommendation that the appointment be confirmed. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing seeing none? So ordered. Who would like to carry these appointments?
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to.
Okay, let's give you Mr. Powers. Okay. I'm going to give Dr. Etlick to Dr. Bates, if that's okay with everyone. And did you want to carry Dr. Smith? We want to carry Dr. Smith?
I'd love it.
That'd be great. Okay, let's do that.
I would do it. I think it's more fitting.
Okay. All right. Thank you. With that, we'll close the work session on executive appointments, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 10. Come on up, Mr. Burson. And I'm sorry we were unable to have you join us on Tuesday. Some of us were not able to get down here. Okay. All right. And everyone should have his testimony in your bill file. I saw it earlier. Marjorie, do you want to? There it is. It looks like this.
Yeah.
Like this? Thank you. All right. Go ahead. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Brown. My name is Ron Burson. I am the Executive Director for Government Standards and Practice Commission. And I want to thank Chair Brown and the members of the committee for inviting me to speak to you today and Tuesday.
Very funny.
Yeah. I think somebody didn't want us to talk on Tuesday. I think that's what it was. Just a little background on the GSPC, the Government Standards and Practices Commission. It was formed in 1974 in response to a ballot measure that was voted on by Oregonians at the time. We actually administer three programs, and they're found underneath Oregon Revised Statutes 244, or Chapter 244, and that chapter has to do with ethics. We also regulate Chapter 171, which is the chapter regarding lobbying, and then Chapter 192, specifically 660, which is the regulation of executive sessions. Underneath ethics, under Chapter 244, these are such things as a public official cannot benefit from their position as a public official. It also lists the gift limitations, reporting requirements of public officials, persons required to file a statement of economic impact or interests. I think there was some talk in the prior testimony last Thursday about the number, and that number is included in your packet there. It's actually, I believe, the back page. And I got a number for us this morning, and as of this morning, there are 4,394 persons that are required to file SEIs, or Statement of Economic Interests, State of Oregon. This statute also deals with conflicts of interest and the requirement to either declare a potential conflict of interest or actual conflicts of interest. It also talks about the makeup of the commission, and then it also delves into the civil penalties. And underneath Chapter 171, this is the requirements of lobbying. And to be a lobbyist, you will have need to lobby for 24 hours or spent $100 in a quarter. So underneath the lobbyist training, especially for state employees, I know we talk a lot about that, keeping track of that time, especially this time of year, and that is actual lobbying time, usually underneath with the public lobbyists. It isn't around the spending of the $100, but the time period. If you do break that time period, you do need to register with the commission. This chapter also delves into reporting requirements, registration, and of lobbyists and entities. And then I talked a little bit about Chapter 192.660, and that is executive sessions, the ability to go into executive session, and any abuses of executive session by any public bodies out there. So these are the chapters, or these are the areas that the agency works on. Now, I'd like to talk a little bit about the investigative process. It seems like there were some questions about that last Thursday. This agency actually has a very extensive investigative process. The agency can either receive a complaint, and that needs to be a signed complaint from anybody out in the public. The executive director would move that to preliminary review, and that information then would be brought to the commission, and that information would be provided to the respondent and to the commission. The respondent would have the opportunity to speak before the commission, and this is just a preliminary review, and what we're looking for there is to see if there is enough information to move forward into the investigative process. Now, we also can have what we call an own motion, and that is information that is received by the commission from an objective outside source, including audit reports, police reports, court proceedings. It's just several different verifiable objective outside sources. That information then is brought to the commission. And at that time, the respondent is notified that information will be brought before the commission, and they can sit before the commission in executive session and explain to them the circumstances around this information. At that time, the commission would make a motion to either dismiss the case or move it into preliminary review. So if it's not a signed complaint, if the commission itself is the one that actually, or the commission staff is the one that actually brings something forward, then there's actually kind of an extra step there. The commission itself would move it into preliminary review. The preliminary review is a 90-day process that is confidential. And so during that process, there will not be any information that is exchanged with the public at that time. at the end of that 90 days, and usually it's less than 90 days, just because of when the commission meets, but we have to actually have it done within that 90 days. If we don't have it done within the 90 days, then it'll actually drop statutorily. So we'll come before the commission again. The person, the respondent, would have a chance to sit before the commission, and they will have a copy of the preliminary review in front of them. They will have received that well before the meeting, and they will be able to explain again to the commission on why this either was not a violation or why it is a violation at that time. And then the commission would actually have to vote to move it to the investigative process. Once that investigative process...
Can you hang on just a second?
Sure.
Any questions on this part, Senator Johnson?
I actually do, and this may be somewhat tangential, so bear with me for a second. I think as many of us do, we race ahead in the presentation materials. And I am guilty as charged. In looking at the staff opinion time studies that you have provided us, I'm curious why in some cases they go forward as unnamed city council. I mean, you're talking about if you make a determination to move ahead, GSPC on its own initiative or a complaint that's been brought to you. I understood what you said about the time periods and the confidentiality. Why is it with respect to the confidentiality that some of these go forward as unnamed city council, unnamed city, and in other cases they're named? What's the differentiation?
Chair Brown, Senator Johnson. Actually, those numbers that I gave you, those are advisory opinions, either by staff or by the commission. It is not a complaint. The commission is asked to give advisory opinions either by staff or by the commission. A commission advisory opinion is actually binding. So if a person, they want to do something, and they'll ask the GSPC beforehand if that's something that they can do per the law, then we will write them an advisory opinion. The reason I have that study in there was this last finding, my understanding was there was some concern about the amount of time that it took the GSPC once somebody asked for this advisory opinion to actually get them that information, and that it was too long. And so they went back last biennium, or this last year, and looked at each one of them. The reason it says unnamed is because it could just be a city asking for it, or it could be an unnamed person in the city that's actually asking for that opinion from the commission or the staff.
Senator Johnson, go ahead.
Then let me just pick another one, and I'm doing this at random. Board of Massage Therapists back in 2002 made a request. 4 months later, you issued the advisory opinion. It took 79 hours to do that of your time. Is that charged back to the Board of Massage Therapists?
Chair Brown, Senator Johnson, no, it is not.
That might be something that we would want to follow up on, because if I understood you correctly, they have asked you for some opinion. Is it appropriate for us to proceed in this direction? And they've asked you not necessarily for a legal opinion. They've asked you for a government standards and practices opinion. It seems to me if they were asking the same question of the DOJ, there would be a Department of Justice, there would be a charge attached to it. I'm trying to figure out why, if they're asking for an advisory opinion on how to conduct operations, I presume, that service should be provided to them essentially gratis. Am I misunderstanding something here?
Chair Brown, Senator Johnson, no, you're not misunderstanding. It is a service that we provide to public officials and public bodies.
Just to follow up on that, but Senator Johnson's point is well taken. I mean, like she said, if we ask the Department of Justice, not we, but if agencies ask for DOJ for legal advice, legal opinions, they have to pay for the research and the response to that. Doesn't it make sense for are we missing something? Doesn't it make sense then for your agency basically to do the same thing? We're just trying to figure out how to fund you, sir. So
exactly where I hit.
Just to add to that, we are required on staff opinions to actually have those go by our Assistant Attorney General. So we are actually required to send them to the Department of Justice, and we are billed, of course, for that.
I was going to say, you pay the Attorney General then for that legal review.
And we're required to have that review.
Senator Johnson.
Something is really out of whack here, and I'm delighted that you provided these for us. Unnamed government entity comes forth at 15 hours. I'm curious why. Unnamed school board, unnamed county fair commission, and for-profit companies. Dell Computer Corporation. why it is that this level of service is being provided for an agency that we are struggling to figure out how to pay you, and this amount of free time is headed out the door.
Chair Brown, Senator Johnson, I have a hard time answering what happened in the past because I don't know why we were doing that, but it is an obligation that we have given, and I'm just guessing. I'd actually have to see the actual opinion for Dell Computers that you mentioned, but if I was guessing, well, I could actually get that information to you if you'd like to have it, but I think a for-profit company is asking if they can provide something probably to a public official.
Some kind of service.
And so we're giving them some type of opinion around that.
At the risk of beating this to death,
Senator Johnson,
thanks
for not using the dead horse theory.
Is this still, however, the practice? Yeah. Even though these are, well, I see these dated now into 2006, as late as November of 2006. So it is still your practice to provide hours and hours, 52 hours, 29, 36, 55. I'm just picking these at random, 298, 61. It's still your practice to provide this service without the expectation of remuneration.
Chair Brown, Senator Johnson, yes it is.
Thank you.
Senator Farrelly.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Are these advisory opinions privileged communication?
Chair Brown, Senator Farrelly, I would actually have to check on that. And once they are actually published after, you know, after they're issued, but if you're asking me during the time that they're being made, they would probably be agency information until, like you say, we do run them by Department of Justice. And I also want to point out on these opinions, when you're looking at that, there is a difference between a staff opinion and an advisory opinion from the commission.
Okay.
An advisory opinion from the commission is binding by the commission, and they actually vote on that. So if I give a person or an entity a staff opinion and they would like to progress that to an advisory opinion from the commission, they can ask for that, and then we would bring that to the commission for a vote to have the commission. Okay, that's why there's a lot less advisory opinions on there than staff opinions.
Senator Farrelly.
If the communications are not privileged and you publish the information afterwards, are they available electronically also? In other words, is there a searchable database people could look possibly and benefit from the research that you've done?
Chair Brown, Senator, yes, they are. They are published on our website.
Okay, and then, Madam Chair, just a conclusion. I see no reason if they're public information, not privileged, that we list any of them as unnamed. It seems pointless to if they're not privileged communication and the information is published afterwards, that the nature of the question and the questioner should be a public record.
And Chair Brown, just a comment on that is I don't know why on the report they were actually called unnamed. I wasn't with the agency at the time, and I agree with you that if somebody's asking us for an opinion, they can either tell us what entity they're with or who they are. I don't think that's a problem. I don't know why it was that way.
Just an observation, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Ferry. Senator Johnson.
One last question, Mr. Burson. I'm just again picking another one at random. Palmer Creek Water District Improvement Company, 134 hours. Have you priced those 134 hours? What do those 134 hours cost your agency? Do you know your unit cost?
Chair Brown, Senator Johnson, I would actually have to look at that, but it is usually myself or it is the investigator that are writing those opinions. And so if you're asking me the cost of that, I guess we would look at our per-hour cost.
Madam Chair, I would like to respectfully request through the chair that Mr. Burson come back with that information so that we have a unit cost per hour.
Okay. And then I do think we need to wrestle with the confidentiality piece that you raised, Senator Farrelly, particularly if they're seeking legal advice. And so it's sort of it's not a pure analysis, I don't think, and it's a little tricky there. So I think we need to wrestle with that question. And I don't know how you would determine, Senator Johnson, sort of hourly investigative rates, but I'm sure you can come up with something just to give us an estimate. But, definitely. This is crazy because you've got a number of entities, including newspapers, who are asking for a public service and probably should be paying for that service while they're accessing it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Johnson?
Department of Justice is able to figure out their per unit cost to agencies, and so
right.
there should be no reason that GSPC can't price their unit costs.
Oh, no question about it. It's a little different because I don't know what your comparison. You're not doing. Are you doing legal research? Is that what you're doing?
Chair Brown, we receive a wide variety of questions into the office, and so it would depend on what we're asked. It could be something that's fairly simple to something that's very complex. An example of ones that I've seen is opinions on, you know, is this a conflict of interest? If, you know, we're selling this piece of property for that piece of property, and this was, so it can get quite complex, and I don't know if you're asking me we are given a legal opinion.
From the Department of Justice.
Well, it actually is from the GSPC, but it is reviewed by the Department of Justice.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Okay, that's very interesting. Senator Farrielly?
Well, Madam Chair, I think this line of questioning opened by our good senator to my left, not on every issue, really does, in fact, speak to the issue of the blanks that are in Senate Bill 10. And we're looking at assessing possibly thousands or even tens of thousands of people in public agencies in order to produce a funding base. And even if only 4,000 or so are required to file the form, that probably is too narrow a base to fund the agency out of.
Correct.
So it looks to me like we're at some point in time looking at nearly 40,000 public officials for the assessment portion, if not for the filing portion. And it seems to me that perhaps the good Senator Johnson has discovered a mechanism, the unit cost mechanism that we use for other state agencies. Because, you know, I can see us in a situation with Senate Bill 10, the way it's headed, that we're assessing agencies, you know, $10 per public official, and none of them are required to file the GSPC form.
Thanks, Senator. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, and I'm sorry that the light bulb is coming on so slowly. After a whole interim of working on this, this display just sort of was the duh moment.
Well, Senator Johnson, I don't think you're the only one. I didn't understand that. So, I mean,
the other thing that it asks, at least in my opinion, is a staffing question. It seems to me that if customer service includes a speedy turnaround with reliable data that can be counted on, you have a very cumbersome process right now where your folks develop an opinion, and the folks developing the opinion may or may not be lawyers. Then that opinion is passed over to the DOJ, where it's actually looked at by lawyers. It seems to beg the question of, are you adequately staffed? Should you perhaps, and I'm just making this up as I'm talking to you, should you perhaps not have a cadre of your own lawyers that are specialists in this in the issue areas that deal with the kinds of questions that are posed to you, instead of farming the work out to DOJ that sees it with a fresh set of eyes? Shouldn't you maybe have your own lawyers? And I'm not asking you to respond right now, but I am asking you at least to be receptive to the concept that maybe you're structured incorrectly.
And I don't know if you want to respond at this point or not. I think it also raises the issues of if the DOJ, Department of Justice, or an AG is reviewing the opinions that you're giving, is there some sort of attorney-client relationship that's developed between the asker of the question and the AAG? And if there's not, I just think that's sort of an odd situation, and legally can then, once it's given, I assume they can rely on that advice, and if it's an advisory opinion, that they can then rely on that advice. But I just think it's sort of in a curious relationship, which sort of really begs Senator Johnson's question of, you know, should you be staffed with lawyers that are giving all of these folks legal advice as well? So I don't know if we want to respond or not, because this is totally off where we were talking about, but...
Yeah, Chair Brown, I guess if I went a little further with my presentation, because I just wanted to point out that the staff opinion time study, again, it was put out there to try to see what our response time was. And actually, the number of opinions that we give, it isn't the largest portion of our time spent in the office. And as far as the attorneys go, we do have a attorney that's been assigned to our office for quite some time, and she is well aware of our statutes and
okay.
our laws and rules. And so we do have a relationship with that particular attorney with the Department of Justice.
Sir Johnson, and then we need to move on.
And I want to correct myself, because in looking at this, I made the assumption that each one of these was hours. It's actually days. There still is a unit of time in your preparation that I would still like to have priced. But what you have put in here is that, and again, let's just pick one, National Purchasing Partners, LLC, and I have happened on another for-profit one simply to emphasize that point. You were in possession of that for 77 days. Now, I don't know out of that 77 days what that translates into in hours, but I just want to acknowledge on the record that I had confused days and hours.
That can happen in this building, man.
And I guess the other sort of just public policy question is, if we want people to comply with ethics laws, which I assume we do, would we be charging them to get information so that they can be in compliance? And I think that's the overriding policy concern, that if we want the city of Albany, for example, to be in total and complete compliance, are we going to charge them to get information so they can comply? So I just want to kind of push back. You understand what I'm asking?
Madam Chair,
Senator Farrelly?
At the end of the day, they'll be begging us for a per official assessment.
Okay. And I just want to mention, you know, Senator Farrelly, you mentioned the lack of the holes in Senate Bill 10. The reason why Senate Bill 420 was essentially included in Senate Bill 10 is because despite the fact that Senate Bill 420 was heard last time around and received substantial opposition, and despite the fact that we funded a law commission project over the last 18 months, no one has been able to come forward, to me at least, with a dedicated funding source for the GSPC. And so for want of another proposal, this is the one that was included. If folks in this committee are not happy with that proposal, and if members in the audience are not happy, and I know there are some who are not, I really encourage you to come forward, because we've been waiting 18 months for someone else to come up with a proposal, and no one else has. And so that's why this particular proposal was included in this bill. So if someone else has got a better idea, come forward. I don't have any investment in this particular one. Senator Farrelly.
I'm sure. I think that every member of the committee understood, upon introduction of Senate Bill 10, this was a point of beginning,
mm-hmm.
and that it tried to bring together only some of the concepts from the Public Commission and the Law Commission,
mm-hmm.
and add those to others that members of the committee might develop, or that we might develop from public testimony or legislative input. So, in the beginning, I think that's the caveat here.
Okay, keep going. Let's
okay,
go.
Okay. Now, I guess what we were to is we were through the 90-day confidential preliminary review process, and then that would move to an investigative process. That's 120 days. We are allowed one extension of 30 days. And during that 120 days, we could also expand the scope. If in the investigation we find some other violation out there, we could expand the scope during that 120-day process. This is a public process, so it is all the information becomes public information, and people, Oregonians, could actually look at the file. So it's complete. We disclose everything, not only to the person, the respondent, but to the public at that time. If there is no, after the 120 days, the commission again would vote to move forward to a contested case. If there was no request for a hearing, there would be a default order, and that gives somebody 21 days to appeal that. Now, during that contested case, currently the law allows a person to either go through the Administrative Procedures Act and have it heard before an administrative hearings officer, or they can choose to opt out of that process and go to Marion County Court.
Okay.
So they actually get a couple of choices on where they'd like to go at this time. The Marion County Court, the agency, has come out and been against that idea. We would like to see that the respondents stay in the Administrative Procedures Act. And the reason I say that is because the cost to go to Marion County Court is extremely high for the agency, and therefore we just really don't go to a lot of contested cases because of that. I'm sorry. Yeah, question.
Senator Johnson?
Thank you. Respectfully, what you just said just bothers me enormously. That somehow because of cost, we GSPC would fight people's removal to the court system. Or what you also said, and I just want to make sure I heard you clearly, we don't go to contested case hearings because of the cost. That's kind of frightening to me.
Senator Brown, I'm sorry, Chair Brown, Senator Johnson, I'm sorry, I must have been misunderstood there. First of all, the cost to go to Marion County Court, at this time during the Law Commission hearings, there was a portion of that they were going to eliminate the opt-out, in other words, the ability to option out of the Administrative Procedures Act and go to Marion County Court. The agency was in favor of that because of the cost was so high for the agency at that time. And
let me make sure I heard you. The agency was not in favor of that because of the high cost to the agency.
No,
it was in favor.
In favor of eliminating
the circuit court
to
opt-out
go to
provision.
Marion County Court. We would like to be treated like every other state agency and have a person heard by an administrative hearings officer. That option was put into place before the Office of Administrative Hearings was even developed. And so now that has been developed, we would like to go through that process. Now, the second thing you asked me was around, does the agency stay away from contested cases because of costs? The agency works to try to settle these cases before contested case hearing, and there is some information back here on the number that actually go to contested case hearing as opposed to ones that are settled. And the majority of the cases are settled with the GSPC beforehand. It does not mean that we eliminate the civil penalties or the sanctions that are out there. We just simply settle those before we actually go to contested case. The majority of them are. And they can settle through any part of this process that I've discussed earlier.
That answer your question, Senator Johnson?
It answers it. I'm not sure I like the answer, but it answers it.
Okay. Senator Farrioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My understanding is if in a contested case an individual has reason to want to seek a review or appeal, they would end up in the Marion County Court anyway. Is that not the case?
Chair Brown, Senator Farrioli, if they have went through the Administrative Procedures Act and the hearings officer had issued their order, and then the commission would come back and put out the final order. If they disagreed with that final order, they would end up in the appeals court, in the appellate court of the state of Oregon, not Marion County Court.
Okay. I guess it's my understanding that the reason for creating the opt-out was to get into a judicial setting as opposed to an administrative setting. I think we should understand very clearly that there may be reasons that we want to participate or that we want to preserve that right. I think we should be very careful as a committee to figure out what it was that the framers of the legislation intended originally. Relative to Senator Johnson's question about contested cases and cost, isn't it true that every unit of judicial government seeks to avoid litigation and court trials across the board? Don't they all try to settle these things? You know, we've had 40 prosecutors in the very same chair that you're sitting in, and they all use settlement as a viable tool to dispose of issues rather than incur the cost of going to trial.
Chair Brown, Senator Farrioli, I'd be hard-pressed to testify for every agency out there, but I would hope that would be the case, that we would try to settle the case at the earliest possible time.
Mr. Burson, I'm going to have you do another 6 minutes, and then I have a number of folks that signed up that were also here on last Thursday, so I'd like to bring them on.
That's fine. Then
I noticed the good commissioner from Wallowa County, and I don't know if he's here to testify or just beautify the room, but wanted to give him an opportunity if he wanted to come forward as well. So
I will be brief.
Okay.
The next part,
we can grab you anytime.
That's okay.
I think this is, like Senator Ferriello said, the beginning of the conversation, not the end.
That's okay. I would like to get to this part, though. When we talk about the number of people out there, everybody's asked this agency how many public officials are in the country. And what I have tried to use is PERS, Public Employee Retirement System, as a starting point. And currently, as of 2006, there are 156,698 public employees out there that are on the PERS system. Now, this does not include the Portland Police Bureau or the Portland Fire District. Those are two large ones that are not included in this.
And that would not include volunteers as well. Is that correct?
That is correct. It would not include volunteers either with the state of Oregon or with any other entity that's out there.
Okay.
Now,
Adam,
I also...
Can we have that number one more time, please?
Yes.
Sorry, the number of currently out there in 2006 per the PERS report is 156,698. Now, out of that group, again, it does not include the volunteers. It does not include Portland and some other ones. Anyway, what I wanted to do was, the best estimate that we have out there is about 170,000 public officials. And again, so when we're talking about number of public officials, there was some testimony earlier about they wouldn't have an impact, but all those 170,000 people are underneath public officials underneath our laws and susceptible to sanction for those laws. Currently, there are 1,300 lobbyists out there, and I think I talked earlier about the number of statement of economic interest filers. Now, in the Law Commission, they also recommended adding the cities in that are not currently underneath that for statement of economic interest. And during the time in 1974 when this ballot measure went through, if their population were not in favor of it at that time, in other words, passed by 50%, then they were not included in these laws.
Opt-outers.
So, and I think, it's been 30-plus years since that, so that was one thing the Law Commission was recommending.
Mr. Burson, how many cities is that? Do you have a sense?
I want to say it's 91 cities.
Okay.
Have opted out, Madam Chair.
That are not part of the requirements for SEI. Okay. I also had an interesting phone call yesterday that I'd like to share with the committee. I actually had a person calling for a director of a state agency where their commission members are required to file a statement of economic interest, but the director themselves is not. And they were calling because the director had actually gone on a trip and wanted to know if they had to report that. And they do not because they're not required to file an SEI. And so when we look at the list underneath 244, my suspicion is that list of people has not been looked at for quite some time, too.
Senator Johnson?
The other piece that I'm curious about is what's the performance of the folks that are required to file and either have just elected not to or are delinquent?
Chair Brown, Senator Johnson, we actually send them out the report, and if they don't file, it would be followed up, and there is a civil penalty for not filing the report. After a letter.
Okay, let me put a finer point on my question. Could you give us a breakdown of the number of, as my colleague characterizes them, nasty grams you've sent out, and how many have resulted in the filing of a penalty, and how many of those penalties have been collected?
Okay. Chair Brown, Senator Johnson, I have included part of this in this report. It does not include the penalties, but on the bottom of this report, it will tell you the number of forms that were sent, the number of forms filed by 415, which is when it's due, same time as your taxes are due, the percent that are returned by that date, the number they get a second notice is 445 here, and as of non-filers, two hearing, we took 20 people to task. So out of the 4,345 that we sent out in 2006, only 20 of them did not file.
Yes, ultimately.
Ultimately did not file and faced a sanction.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, I'm going to cut you off at this point. We thank you very much. We appreciate your time and energy, and we look forward to hearing from you again extensively. Commissioner Boswell, did you wish to testify, or are you just here to listen?
Well, I just happened on this hearing, but if you're going to give it a chance, I have something to say.
Come on up. We want to hear from you.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Brown, members of the committee. Actually, three of the people I came to see are on the panel.
Is this lobbying at the greatest?
But I want to just share with you on behalf of AOC, and I am the immediate past president of that association. I'm Ben Boswell, Willow County Commissioner from Lostine. And the roads aren't that bad, by the way.
Well, I'm impressed that you're here. Holy smokes.
AOC has not taken a position on this bill. We're having some internal discussions that are somewhat similar to your own. What we'd like to do is establish some principles that accomplish what we would all like to accomplish in terms of faith and trust and fairness in the government and the conduct of the public officials. Some of the principles that we will look for is equity and effectiveness. And so to that end, I don't know how the processing of the bill will go, but it might be that a work group including AOC represent actually all local government representatives. I'll be bold and include all of them because I'm sure they'd like to be included. But at this time, given the constraints that we have on our budgets and some of the potential deep holes that may exist depending on our federal relationship, we'd like to maintain a relationship with the state that is like I say, fair and equitable. And if there are charges being suggested for services the state provides to the local governments, we'd like to examine possibly some of the services provided by local government to the state that are currently not being charged for.
That's pretty good, Commissioner Boswell. I assume specifically you're talking about Senate Bill 1145, amongst others.
Amongst others, yes. And in terms of cost accounting, I think it's fair that the citizens of Oregon should know exactly what it's costing for the services that they're receiving. And what we may end up doing is moving some money around and getting it where it ought to be. But hopefully, you know, we're all going to have enough to get the job done.
Thank you. Questions?
Sir Nelson.
He's always succinct.
He's very good.
Point, doesn't he?
Commissioner Boswell, I think what we're wrestling with is the direct conflict of interest that we see that we have by determining how much money goes into the Government Standards and Practices Commission, and they're the ones supposed to hold our ethical feet to the fire. So that's kind of what we're wrestling with, and so I don't think we're wanting to punish local governments and just looking for a sort of a fair way, like you said, fair and equitable way to fund this very important commission. So
I presumed it was our mutual interest.
Yes. Sir Ferrioli.
Madam Chair, two comments. One, Commissioner Boswell, for the record, charges this committee to observe the principles of faith, trust, and fairness. And I think that's good advice for the committee. The other thing, of course, is that we've seemed to run out of private citizens to tax, so now we're going to create a mechanism so one state agency can tax another.
We do it all the time, Sir Ferrioli.
That's great.
Fee for service.
Anything else for Commissioner Boswell? We really appreciate you joining us this morning, and I'm sure the three of us on this panel, and we don't know who we are, will look forward to meeting with you afterwards since you've... How many hours? Took you 6 hours to get here?
It took 7 yesterday.
7. Okay.
A little slow over through the gorge. I got stuck behind a plow.
It was probably safer
Which
that way.
Good thing.
Yes, yes. Well, thanks for joining
Thank
us.
You. Well, actually, I have another meeting to attend, so I'll catch you next trip, which will be sometime next week.
Okay. We'll look forward to seeing with you, and hopefully there won't be any snow.
Thank you.
Take care. All right. Next, I'm going to bring up Genoa Ingram and Norman Turrell. Pearl, sorry, it rhymes with pearl. And and then in the queue we have Steve Bryant and Paul Snyder. Good morning and welcome. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Brown. Janoa Ingram, Executive Director, the Oregon Fire District Directors Association. We did participate in the work group that met in 2003 to overhaul the ethics statutes, as well as with Senator Johnson and numerous others, a host of others, during the interim with the Oregon Law Commission. The fire service comes at this issue at a little different angle. Our primary concern is the impact that it has on the attraction and the retention of volunteer firefighters, and in addition, the phenomenon, if you will, of the upside-down application of the ethics laws to the point where a volunteer firefighter, for example, is held to a more stringent set of rules than currently a legislator or a lobbyist is. We would like to see the Oregon Law Commission package brought forward and discussed. While we have no official position on Senate Bill 10, as you've discussed, it is an excellent springboard to begin these discussions. But there are just a host of issues that have not been addressed that the Oregon Law Commission did look at that we are very, very anxious to discuss.
Ms. Ingram, if I can just stop you right there. Two questions. One, if we were to move volunteers from the financial piece of Senate Bill 10, would that alleviate 19 or 18 pages of your concerns? And secondly, could you just give me some more specifics, at least under Senate Bill 10, of how you see firefighters being held to a different standard than the legislature?
Thank you for that invitation, Chair Brown. Yes, our primary concern is the attraction and the retention of volunteer firefighters. It is the gift provision that, it is the whole legislative and administrative interest provision that has us concerned. For example, there was an exemption carved out some years ago that if a legislative or administrative interest exists, that a gift can be given. That would most commonly be the lobbyist to legislator relationship. However, in the case of a volunteer firefighter, there is no legislative or administrative interest. And in the discussions that went on in 2003, and to some extent in the Oregon Law Commission discussions, there are many times where incentives are offered to a volunteer that are not acceptable because there is no legislative or administrative interest, therefore no gift can be given, if you will. And FEMA, for example...
I'm completely lost. Could you give some examples?
I just don't understand what you're saying.
Absolutely. Up until this legislative session, for example, it was common practice for a lobbyist to take a legislator out to dinner, and they could spend upwards of $100 for gifts, et cetera. Now, we have received opinions from the Government Standards and Practices Commission, and the Oregonian grabbed a hold of it, and it was the infamous plate of cookies scenario. During the discussions of House Bill 3328 in the 2003 session, a number of us sat around the table with attorneys, and everyone came to the conclusion, because no legislative or administrative relationship existed in the case of a volunteer, that, for example, no...
That was an actual advisory opinion from the GSPC, that there was no administrative interest?
It was part of the discussion. There were two members of the commission that participated in the discussion in the 2003 session, and that was the conclusion that all of us around the table came up with. It was the infamous...
So it's not an advisory opinion from GSPC, that there is no administrative interest?
Correct. However, it was commonly accepted at that time. I believe the League of Oregon Cities used the example of, well, if it's the birthday of a city official, can they or can they not accept, for example, a bouquet of flowers across the fence from the neighbor? I mean, it was just the whole balancing act of the legislative or administrative interest has been a source of consternation for local governments, and particularly those who use the services of volunteers. There was...
Johnson?
I still am having trouble with this. I mean, you're building an argument based on what I perceive as a flawed premise. You had a conversation. Somebody came up with the conclusion that there was no administrative interest. Ergo, we now make the leap that you can't hand somebody a daisy when they put your garage fire out?
Senator Johnson, I'm sorry, Senator Brown, Senator Johnson, that was the testimony and the conclusion surrounding House Bill 3328 in the 2003 session. It was stated at that time that the plate of cookies that was given to the fire service was not acceptable. This is the 2-case scenario. I did receive calls from fire districts who said, you know, especially after 9/11, there was a great deal of outpouring toward fire districts. People wanted to bring baked goods, et cetera. I had called the staff of GSPC at that time and said, what is the policy? And we were told at that time by the previous director that because there was no legislative or administrative interest, they interpreted it to mean that there could, that no gift could be given.
Madam Chair, Johnson, I would like to just respectfully ask that maybe we reset the clock. I hate to see you sit here and build an argument based on what I think is a substantially flawed premise. And instead of us trying to divine what the last director of GSPC said, if this remains unresolved, let's get an opinion. Let's not build a proposition around something that may be not factual. And frankly, I've been in this building long enough to see a lot of testimony that doesn't equate to fact. And so I'm at a position right now where I can't accept your argument because I think the foundation for it is flawed.
Senator Brown, Senator Johnson, nothing would make us happier. But that's what we were told during the discussion surrounding House Bill 34.
Okay. Told, but all right. I would agree with Senator Johnson. I'm really struggling here because I think the goal of Senate Bill 10, and I believe the Law Commission work, was to have a simple and clear guidelines for all of the public officials in the state, including the volunteer firefighters. And I don't think this bill was written. I know this bill was written to provide a different standard for legislators than there is for volunteer firefighters.
Senator Brown, yes, Senate Bill 10 does fix that because it does say a gift may be given in those cases where no legislative or administrative interest exists, and we applaud that and we appreciate that.
Okay.
There are a great, yes.
I think we're still wrestling with your underlying premise that there is an administrative interest for volunteer firefighters and that they would need to comply with the limits just like everyone else, which is why we tried to set something we thought was somewhat reasonable.
Chair Brown, may I give you an example?
Please.
Immediately after 9/11, JCPenney sent around a letter. It was known as the Dear Hometown Hero letter. And it went to fire districts, police departments all around the country. I have a copy of that letter in my House Bill 3328 file. We faxed that letter over to Government Standards and Practices Commission. And again, this was after 9/11, so it's several years ago. And we said, would our public safety individuals be able to take advantage of this discount that they were offering on, you know, public Hometown Hero Day? And we were told that no, again, because no legislative or administrative interest existed, that in Oregon, at least, that type of gift would not be acceptable for a volunteer.
Senator Johnson. Let me just understand this. So this was to go in and get a 10% discount off purchases over $5,000 or whatever it is. I'm making this up. But there was some remunerative offer being made by JCPenney to people who could demonstrate that they were volunteer firefighters.
Senator Brown, Senator Johnson, that is absolutely correct. We asked for an opinion because apparently a number of fire districts received that letter, and so we forwarded it on to Government Standards and Practices and said, on this particular day that they've set aside, can they go in and make a purchase and receive a 10% discount? And we were told no, because there is no.
Was the same discount being extended to paid staff in firehouses?
Yes, okay. It was.
I have the gavel, but I'll still refer to the chair.
No, it's fine. I'm out of here. Like me to leave.
You know, I think the more celebrated instances where public attention was focused on conflict of interest is driving this process. The question of how fine to make the mesh on the screen is the one that we're wrestling with. And I don't know that I can speak for anyone but myself on this committee, but Chase and Fire Department volunteers is not, or fair board members or cemetery board members is certainly not what I had in mind. And I guess I just throw that open to the rest of the committee members. Let us proceed with the testimony.
Thank you, Senator Farioli. We appreciate that very much. If I could, just one last point on the attraction and retention issue. We did introduce legislation in 2001 over a very real issue, and it may not seem like a big deal currently as we're looking at the whole ethics picture, but there was also a situation where we were actually losing volunteers because the way the ethics laws were interpreted, a volunteer firefighter could bring his or her girlfriend or boyfriend and receive a dinner, but however because the statute clearly says that you cannot benefit by being the relative of a public official, the wives or husbands of the firefighter were required to pay for their meal. And this caused, it doesn't sound, in the whole big picture, it doesn't sound like a big deal, but we were actually losing volunteers because the spouse would say, look, if I don't get my meal for free and that person who's not married does get the meal for free, then I don't want you going down to the station any longer. And it was causing a real problem for us.
Thank you. Again, respectfully, Genoa, I think that's taken on some of the proportions of urban myth. I would love to know how many instances there actually were where someone resigned their commission as a volunteer fire person over a $17.95 roast beef dinner. It's my experience in knowing many volunteer firefighters that they take such pride of association and are so dedicated to the work that they do on behalf of others in their communities that tipping point seems to me to be so de minimis as to be incredulous. I mean, I'm incredulous hearing it. I just hate to keep repeating these things that take on a patina of truth and actuality. I agree with my colleague, Senator Farioli, and I saw nods from other colleagues. Nobody wants to deprive a firefighter out of taking his wife to the Christmas dinner where she might get $11 worth of ham and green beans. But I think we are trying to get some kind of an understandable application of some ethical standard regardless of who it is when they are serving at the public trust. And but believe me, none of us are here to take away a Christmas dinner from a volunteer firefighter. And what I want to get us away from is repeating this kind of mythology and get down to the facts. If it really did have a chilling effect and you can show us resignations that tipped on a question of a dinner, I'd like to see that.
Thank you, Chair Farioli. Senator Johnson, I would like to meet with you, and I'll be calling to make that appointment to go over that information.
Well, I think, respectfully, Mr. Chair, this is data for the whole committee. You don't need to come up and convince me alone. I think this is information that we all would benefit from, and if you want to just get us the evidence, we'd be happy to receive it.
Absolutely. I'm happy to provide that information to the committee. Once again, we are in favor of the Oregon Law Commission package that brings balance to the entire ethics application of those laws. We are further in favor of laws that will allow some incentive program to volunteers. And with the last point that I had with regard to the funding of the commission, we are wholeheartedly in support of the governor's budget that provides a 46% increase to the Government Standards and Practices Commission. We are again concerned if public officials are assessed a fee with whether or not they are paid or not. There is some concern about the impact that it will have on the smaller districts because obviously it takes more volunteers to make up a worksheet, for example, or a work schedule than it would if someone is paid to be there for 8 hours. So we would like to see hopefully not an assessment against each public official that serves the body. Those are my primary points, and I, again, am happy to answer any additional questions, and I will provide the committee with the testimony and the background that went into our bill in 2001 relating to the dinners. Thank you so much.
Further questions? And Mr. Turrell?
Yes.
Any further testimony to offer?
Yes. He has a testimony.
I haven't had a chance yet.
And there would be further testimony.
Senator Farioli, or Chair Farioli, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Norman Turrell. I'm the first vice president and action chair of the League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League of Women Voters of Oregon is a grassroots, nonpartisan political organization which encourages the informed and active participation of citizens in government. Thank you for this opportunity to discuss Senate Bill 10, Ethics Legislation, the League of Women Voters has been following the discussion of ethics and the Government Standards and Practices Commission since the 2005 session, or legislature, forwarded the issue to the Oregon Law Commission. We commend the Law Commission and its two work groups for their year-long consideration of the matter and the recommendations they adopted, some of which are now contained in SB 10. The League of Women Voters has long held the position that government should be open, responsible, and accountable to the citizens whom it represents. We believe SB 10 ethics legislation will help public officials focus on being accountable, responsible, and responsive to all citizens of Oregon. The League supports a dedicated and stable source of funding for the GSPC and sufficient funding to allow it to perform the oversight that the voters expected when they passed the law in 1974. SB 10 appears to solve the funding issues of the GSPC in a more effective way than previous proposals considered by the OLC. We also suggest some accommodation or exception from the proposed assessments for public bodies that utilize volunteers and that have a budget that is predominantly donations, such as some volunteer fire departments. SB 10 also appears to solve the issue of gifts to public officials in a way that the League strongly supports. We are very pleased that SB 10 removes the exceptions from the definition of gift for food, lodging, and travel, and food and beverage or entertainment when in the presence of the provider. The provider in these situations was often a well-funded professional lobbyist. Most ordinary citizens and advocates for public interest groups do not have such resources. These exceptions allowed access to legislators that most Oregonians cannot afford. The League strongly supports the provisions in SB 10 for electronic reporting to the GSPC and for making this information available online to ensure easy public access. The League also supports the quarterly reporting timelines in SB 10. We would also like to suggest incorporating into the OLC recommendation for amending ORS 260.407 into Section 14 of SB 10 concerning the permitted uses of campaign funds. The OLC has proposed a new ethical approach to campaign contributions. Quote, they are in trust and they are not the candidate's money, but rather are the committee's monies to use, unquote. In particular, the OLC recommendation would not allow campaign contributions to be used to defray public office expenses. This OLC recommendation is tied to another recommendation to increase the Legislative Assembly's budget to pay for reasonable expenses. The League supports both of these recommendations and would like to see a bright line drawn between campaign funding and public office expenses. Thank you for your attention, and I'll be happy to answer questions.
Questions? Mr. Pearl, I do have. Senator, do you have a question?
I have your last statement of drawing the bright line between campaign funding and public office expenses. In a perfect world, that would be fine to do, but in the real world, it's pretty hard, I think, when you're an elected official to separate the two. I mean, like a typical day or week for me would be I leave Pendleton, I drive to Boardman 50 miles for some meetings, legislative meetings. Then I come home, and then maybe I'll drive to Enterprise. It's 150 miles to Enterprise. And during that course of time, I'm meeting people, going places, seeing things, but I'm also making sure I get to the radio station, the newspaper. I may even be calling people up for campaign funds. And so am I on legislative business or am I on campaign business? I'm actually doing both. I think that whatever you're doing as a public official, you're in that dual capacity at all times. I mean, you just don't say, okay, I'm a legislator here, no, I'm not a legislator. And whether that's good or bad, I think that's the reality of how things operate. And so, you know, I in a perfect world, I think that is a wonderful thing that we ought to be doing. If we could just leave our partisan hats at the door when we could check in, but realistically, that just doesn't happen. And I know you want the perfect world, but you know, we have to deal with not a very large income, not a very large expense base. We do get some expenses, but I can go through that in about a week or 2 weeks in my part of the district, because I'm traveling 250 miles from end to end and 100 miles north and south. So it's, you know, I can appreciate, and I really thank you for bringing this up, because I mean, I think we have to look at this and the open reporting. I don't think anybody wants to get away from the open reporting, my whole sense of this thing is that here we are looking at whether a volunteer should have cake and cookies, and you know what legislators are doing, and all of a sudden we've got $900,000 that is being donated to both political parties. I mean, to me, there's the big money. I'm starting to feel like I'm a piker here.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Johnson.
I guess I would just like to add a finer point to that. I've been away from my legislative responsibilities attending to some family health issues, and I can recall hours sitting in St. Charles Hospital making credit card calls, my own personal credit card, trying to just stay up with business in the district. And there's no mechanism to account for that. I'm using AT&T credit cards, which happen to be probably one of the most expensive ways to do it, but that's the credit card that I had in my pocket. And so in an effort to try to keep up with our expenses, we end up doing those kind of uncompensated things. Clearly, I think, as part of this whole ethics discussion, some kind of review for reasonable office expenses makes sense. I cover 5 counties in my district. It's not uncommon that I'll drive 80,000 miles, and my driving pales in comparison to my colleagues who cover half of Oregon. And so I guess in all of this discussion, I just don't want people to lose track of the fact that it is with considerable economic hardship to legislators that we serve. And we do it in order to be at the 4-H dinner in Tillamook, in order to show up at the Women's Resource Center auction in Astoria, and all the driving that all of us do simply to serve our constituents. So I appreciate the fact that you have linked some recognition of those costs to adequate remuneration to run our offices. I also just feel compelled to add that I have constituents call and they say, well, put your staff person for Veterans Affairs on this. And I think that they routinely confuse us with our federal colleagues who have staff with issue areas. I've got one staff and a volunteer that I about beat to death. And we take care of 120,000 people, and I just feel compelled to point out, because this is a live committee hearing and others are listening to this, just a little sort of, as Senator Nelson did it, welcome to our world, in order to take care of the people that we're taking care of with pretty limited budgets, and the increasing demands on legislators' time and the expectation that we'll be present for events that happen in the district, it is financially pretty burdensome. And I think we would all ignore that at our peril, where we'll get a situation in the legislature where only people of financial substance can serve. And that would be exceedingly wrong.
Chair Farioli and Senator Johnson and Senator Nelson, I appreciate the difficulties of serving in public office, and it's a personal burden that I know it would be difficult for me to do. I think in fear of speaking for the Oregon Law Commission, I think that their concerns were partly motivated by the double-dipping episodes during the last session, where legislators were paying for housing in Salem with their campaign funds,
sure,
and thus being able to having to use that money for other purposes. And I think adequately funding the legislative business by the legislature is very important, that our legislators should be supported with adequate funding. And that's why I've linked it to the other proposal for the Oregon Law Commission.
Follow on.
I would follow up by saying adequate funding and the demand for adequate accountability.
Mm-hmm.
I think if there was some provision made to compensate legislators for office expenses, telephone, the usual and customary office expenses, that there should be the concomitant requirement that those be accounted for with great precision.
I agree.
Further questions?
To point it out, I think you, Mr. Pearl, have put your finger on the larger issues that we referred to earlier. And then the question of how fine the screen that we put on this ethics issue is of concern. And also the unintended consequence. The volunteer firefighter example gets further complicated when you realize that some of the volunteer firefighters work for tax-supported districts. Mm-hmm. We have fire protection districts, which are taxing districts in rural eastern Oregon. And so, you know, you're mixing a volunteer who is uncompensated with an agency that is a tax-supported agency that has a levy that it annually levies against the property values of the community. So when we go to assess those agencies, you're not really assessing the volunteer, you're assessing the entity on a per capita basis for the number of volunteers. So there are some complications that we need to work through. I appreciate the testimony. I would ask you if the League of Oregon Voters has considered, or the League of Women Voters has considered, the issue in Senate Bill 10 of the creation of the Legal Defense Trust Fund?
Not specifically, but I think we would be supportive of that particular concept. Yes. That's also in this section of the bill.
Right. And Madam Chair, I'm glad to see your attorney. I still would point out the irony of creating a law so Byzantine in its complexity that legislators are encouraged to have a Legal Defense Trust Fund for the inevitable litigation that we'll pursue. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Farrelly. Any other questions with this panel? Thank you very much. We're glad we're able to finally get you on. Let's get Mr. Bryan up. I know some of you may have to leave for other meetings, but I'd like to get him on. Mr. Schneider, can you come back next week?
Yes, Madam Chair, I can.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate that. Hi.
Hi. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I will try to be brief. My name is Steve Bryant, and I'm currently serving as the legislative director for the League of Oregon Cities. And I'm here to offer some additional comments on Senate Bill 10. We certainly thank you for this opportunity, and I really admire the effort and the seriousness with which you are taking this, the priority with which it has been assigned. During the interim, I was a member of the work group, served with Senator Johnson through many hours of consideration. In fact, I was tempted to bring the volumes of data.
Don't you hurt yourself.
That would have taken a wheelbarrow to bring it over. Very interesting, an eye-opener for me as a member of that work group. And, of course, this is very important business for the state of Oregon. In fact, you'll see in my testimony, there really can be no more important task for this legislature than helping us to restore the trust that people have in those of us who serve the public as public servants. And this bill represents a small but very important part of that task. I have to comment on an area of the bill the League of Oregon Cities has some difficulty with, and that is in Section 2 of the bill concerning the funding issue and the assessments. And I apologize to the Chair for our position there in opposition to the proposal, but I hope you understand the position that this puts our membership in. We have four concerns. I won't dwell much on the volunteer issue. It sounds like you would like to address that. But I need to tell you that both the Ethics Reform Workgroup subcommittees grappled with this issue of dedicated funding, and there was universal agreement in the groups that I participated in that there needs to be increased staffing for the GSPC, and ideally there should be some source of dedicated funding. But the concept of assessments on regulated local government entities was raised in all of those meetings and was consistently rejected by the work groups. At one point, Attorney General Myers did present a proposal. I think it took the form of LC 1227, in which the proposal was that the Secretary of State, the State Treasurer, and the Attorney General recommend a budget, and that sort of becomes a benchmark, and there would be an understanding that that would establish the base level of funding. You're certainly rightly concerned about whether or not that would sail through without further scrutiny by this body, and I can appreciate your concerns there. So we do have this dilemma of how do we achieve the recommendations of every group that's looked at this, that there be a dedicated funding source, and yet deal with the perception issue that will be created if we assess all of these entities for a service that they have long received without charge, which I will address in my additional comments in a minute. Secondly, the point being from those of us at the local level, we're appreciative of the fact that the state has increased resources available to it this biennium. That's not the case at the local level. You heard from counties. Cities are essentially in the same boat. We're struggling mightily with our financial resources in terms of providing the services that our citizens demand. It does not seem like the time to be levying an assessment on local governments from the state. The third issue is that just the principle of a new state assessment for a long-established state-regulated and general-funded activity is troubling, even though the costs would appear to be relatively low compared to some of the services that we receive. And then the fourth point deals with the volunteer issue. I would add to that, and if I can refer you to the language on page 2 of the bill, this comes in subsection 7 in terms of the definition of public official, where it says it means any person who on the date the commission charges the public body is serving the public body as an officer, employee, agent, and otherwise. Troubled with the term agent. And does that mean the realtor that we have on retainer to help us with real estate transactions? Does that mean the consultant that's working on our sewage treatment plant? So I'd ask you to consider the term agent, because I think we would have a hard time interpreting what that means and how inclusive it might be. And I would echo all of the concerns you've heard about volunteers, and I'm sure you appreciate that in the city level we have volunteers for many, many kinds of activities, boards and commissions, the people who pick up litter along roadsides, library volunteers, firefighter volunteers, et cetera. So I appreciate the concerns that I've heard about volunteers, and I trust that that you will find a way to accept them. Let me address the issue that I listened to about GSPC opinions and whether or not there is merit in charging for that service. We at the local level pay a lot of attention to those opinions. Oftentimes questions are asked and most often questions are asked that have universal application. I can think of a few examples that might be useful. For some reason, when cell phones became popular, the GSPC dealt a lot with cell phone complaints. And when public officials are issued a government-issued cell phone, the issue was to what extent, unlike the telephone on your desk where you can call to tell your family you're going to be late for dinner, for some reason picking up the government-issued cell phone and making that same call was problematic because there are per-minute charges that the public is paying for and thus conflicts. If you have a private cell phone that you're paying for, but you're attempting to charge back the public agency for the minutes that you're charged for the public's business, there were issues about, you know, what's a fair rate that you charge. So opinions were asked often about cell phone use, and I think there are several on the record that even though one agency asked the opinion, it was very helpful to all agencies to receive that opinion and be able to search the database to see what opinions have been issued on a given topic. I could cite several examples like that, but I would find it difficult, particularly if we're being assessed for the services of the GSPC, to also then be assessed for seeking an opinion that has universal application to all of our members. And I think it would be problematic when often those opinions are asked in the spirit of, we want to make sure we do this right, to be having to think about, do I really want to pay for that opinion and then risk doing it wrong and having a complaint issued later. So editorial comment on assessing for advisory opinions. In conclusion, I just want to emphasize that we're very supportive of this effort. We think meaningful ethics reform and adequate funding are essential to moving forward. It's timely. It's important. We want to offer our resources to continue to help you as you work through the technical issues. I'm sure we'll see other things later on. We have these aha moments. Oftentimes there are unintended consequences when there is sweeping reform like this that we need to address. We know that we can count on your cooperation and be glad to help any way we can. So you have to answer questions.
Senator Johnson.
I just want to say that one of the reasons that there was no complaint at the end of the Ethics Commission with respect to assessments to local government, I missed the meeting.
Senator Farioli.
This witness has brought to mind a piece of the equation that I think Senator Nelson referred to earlier. One of the ways that legislators in some of the rural areas, at least, have attempted to deal with the issue of not having the conflict of using the public telecommunications system for politics or private business is that they paid for those services entirely with campaign funds. And if we eliminate the ability for people to cover their transportation or communications issues in that way, then what that will do is cause people to either double the technology and have a phone that's public use only, and another one that is for private or personal use, and another one yet that's political. And I would just suggest that for many people, that kind of complexity will weigh into the decision about whether they or not they would be willing to try to compartmentalize their lives to that extent in order to be able to serve. And I'll suggest some will not, or maybe most. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Farioli. My apologies to committee members for running over. We're back on next Thursday at 10:30. Look, stay tuned for any additional evening meetings for next week. Thank you very much. And with that, we're adjourned.
Thank you, Marjorie.
Thank you very much.
We're all late. We'll see you later.